The J. Rieger Distillery, which opened a new facility this summer in the East Bottoms, has been called, and I quote, an unparalleled experience in our city and our region. We'll be taking you there to find out why in a minute. But before that little field trip, J. Rieger & Company is not the only distillery to open here in town in recent years. And though the trend may feel new, this is actually a revival of something Kansas City was kind of known for in olden times. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. And we're starting today's food show with a look back at the distilleries in our city's past, where they went, and why they're coming back now. Our guests are Carla Deal and Pete Doolin, both writers. Pete covers food and drink in his work, and he's written a book called Expedition of Thirst. Hi, Pete.
Good morning.
Carla writes about local history in the online magazine Squeezebox City, and she's got a book coming out in November. It's called Storied and Scandalous Kansas City. Hi, Carla.
Hi, Gina.
So just for context, Pete, how much distilling are we seeing in Kansas City right now?
Right now, quite a bit. There's probably eight or so distilleries that have opened up over the past decade. So there's been kind of a modern boom of local distilleries, and new ones are opening up all the time.
How do you define a distillery, and a spirit for that matter, which is what they make in distilleries?
Sure. So a spirit is, you start off with raw materials, grain, water, depending on the type of spirit, can be other products as well, you know, such as gin, where you might have botanicals in it. You're going to run it through a still to basically distill the spirit, concentrate it down to a very high proof alcohol, and then it's cut with water to a lower proof so that you can drink it and it won't kill you.
It's funny because when I think about spirits, I'm like, well, I can name some. But yeah, thank you for actually defining that term.
And that's a very basic explanation.
All that's needed. Carla, when you look at Kansas City's cultural history, do you consider distilling an important piece of that past?
I think distilling, winemaking, beer making from a historical standpoint has always been kind of the backbone of a lot of our neighborhoods, where people were densely populated, like the West Bottoms, West Side, the North End. All of those neighborhoods all had their fair share of beer makers, winemakers, and distilleries. So I think it's just sort of goes hand in hand to where people are living and where they're populated because they want it.
When was distilling at its height here in town?
I would say the late 1800s, mostly in the West Bottoms and near the River City Market. There were several distilleries. Rieger is one of the most popular ones, and there were a couple other immigrant-run distilleries that gained quite a bit of national popularity too, along with Rieger.
Can you name a couple of those?
The Stolz brothers were German-born brothers, and they claimed to have one of the best whiskeys in town. But they were also operating at the same time as Jacob Rieger's distillery, and they claimed that they could make up to 375,000 gallons of liquor a day.
When you say they claimed, it makes me feel like you suspect they were lying.
Well, there were a lot of very exclamatory remarks in advertisements. You know, when I look back and look at the archives and newspapers and stuff like that, a lot of the advertisements say, we're the best at this. We make the most of this. You know, we can process or produce the most a day. So they were kind of, it's hard to tell, right? How they were advertising, if that was just sort of a hoax to get people to buy their liquor. But there was just so much alcohol consumption in the late 1800s.
Why?
I would say that a lot of, especially when we're talking about the West Bottoms, there were so many people living down there, working, toiling away in the factories, and, you know, 5 o'clock whistle blew and everyone just ran out of the factories and went to all the saloons that were down there. And I think it was just almost out of a need for a reprieve from the conditions of their life, maybe.
You also hear, when you hear about like agricultural history, about times and places where like water was not necessarily super safe to drink. Could that be part of this? I just don't know.
Sure. And there's another, you know, Pete was saying, you know, how you make the liquor and how you cut it and what they would do back then and what Rieger still does today, is that they would cut their liquor with sherry to make it go further. They would, so they could produce what they produced, and then they would cut it with sherry to kind of make it last longer. And I think it, out of a need to continue the production level up to what people wanted to consume.
Yeah, Pete, what can you say about this?
Sure. A couple of thoughts on why people drink so much.
And not that people don't drink a lot still, but...
Well, just to kind of put it in perspective, I did some research for another project, and just by 1830, and this is across the U.S., in 1830, the volume of pure alcohol consumed by the average American was 7.1 gallons. That's pure alcohol. Now, if you were to break that out into actual consumable products, that would be like 34 gallons of beer and cider, about 5 gallons of distilled liquors.
Within what period of time?
Within, I think, a year's time. Now, today, the World Health Organization estimates that Americans, on average, drink about 2.5 gallons of pure alcohol. So again, like if you were to break that out among beer, wine, and spirits, then that alcohol would be diluted. But you know, a little over 100, 150 years ago, people were drinking 3.5 times as much alcohol as today.
That's pretty crazy.
Yeah, and I think a few of the reasons. One, I think the water quality wasn't as good back then. Historically, people that settled in the country and moved westward, just they drank a lot.
It's like chase your water to kill whatever you might have just consumed in it.
Also, like post-Civil War, so like the mid to late 1800s, post-Civil War, a lot of people self-medicated with alcohol. You had a large immigrant population that came through the Midwest. They brought with them a drinking culture from Europe. So it wasn't so much, you know, let's just drink a lot for the sake of drinking. It was part of their culture, and it's more moderated. And then you had, of course, a lot of people that were moving westward through Kansas City and Westport to chase gold or just to be homesteaders and pioneers. So you had a lot of, I think, booze that was sold. And the thing about whiskey in particular that was more consumed among the spirits is that it didn't spoil in the way that beer or wine would. So it's easier to transport, easier to consume.
Huh. There's a fun quote, and I'm just going to paraphrase it. There's a fun quote about Westport during this time where it says that whiskey flows more freely than should be, considering everyone has guns in their pocket. Oh, red, you know. So it was very, you know, quintessential Wild West in Westport, especially Civil War era.
It's easy to forget that Westport, that's like a literal use of two words, West and Port.
Absolutely.
Well, so there's also something called the Wettest Block. What's that about?
Yeah, this is one of the most fun little anecdotes of our history that I think not a lot of people know about. There's not a lot of collected material written about it. If you research the Wettest Block, which is down in the West Bottoms.
Yeah, what block is it?
On 9th Street. It operated within 1,000 feet of the Kansas state line. And so Kansas was dry and Missouri was wet. And so there's a lot of sort of riff back then with the teetotalers from Kansas who hated the fact that the Wettest Block, which had 26 buildings, and out of those 26, 24 were saloons. And so Kansas residents would come over to the Wettest Block. You know, that's where it says that this is where Missouri fed Kansas the liquor. So, and today there's one of those buildings remaining. There's only one building from the Wettest Block that still stands today, and it's a beautiful building. It's 1717 West 9th Street. It was the Antlers Club in the 30s. It was owned by the Pendergast brothers at one point. And it's I feel like, should be renovated. I feel like the city should pay attention to that building. It's an absolutely stunning building.
So you kind of hinted at this, but this whole rivalry and tension between the wets and the dries, which sounds funny to me, honestly.
Well,
but
you know,
I guess it's not funny.
I think that the passion behind that, obviously, like the religious angle where, you know, Carrie Nation came in thinking that it was her mission from God to rid the world of alcohol. And, you know, she certainly spent a lot of time in Kansas City and in Kansas and Missouri. And I mean, she was around during the time when Jacob Rieger was distilling so much whiskey and claiming to be like the world's largest mail order whiskey distillery. And so it's fun for me to kind of imagine those two characters.
That they come from the same period in history.
Absolutely.
And that they are existing in the same geographic region.
Right.
Yeah. And even predating Cary Nation, in Kansas, that had a long history of temperance and that movement that led, that predated prohibition. In fact, Kansas was the first state to enact statewide prohibition in 1881. That was 40 years before national prohibition. And that movement, the temperance movement, kind of rose and fell over several decades in the 1830s and then the 1850s, then again the 1870s, and then ultimately leading to prohibition being enacted in the state in 1881. So you had a lot of people that really disregarded those laws that were being passed on a local level, and there wasn't consistent enforcement. And the fact that Kansas shared the state line with Missouri allowed easy transfer of alcohol back and forth. So you had a lot of people that disregarded the law, and then as these laws were being passed, they could just slip over to Missouri.
So getting back to all the distilling that was going on at the time, we've heard about a couple of the key players. Are there others that have good stories, good, like, fun facts?
Well, I think an important distillery to mention, and it was actually based in Weston, about 45 minutes away, was the Holiday Distillery that was established in 1856. I would imagine they were a pretty big supplier to the Kansas City area. And that was started by the Holiday brothers, who are originally from Kentucky, another place that knew a thing or two about bourbon and whiskey. So they set up their own distillery there because they liked the limestone springs there and the quality of the water that reminded them of the water back in Kentucky. And they thought it was really well suited to producing spirits.
When you think about the demise of this industry, what do you think is important to understand about that?
I think especially in the West Bottoms, the distilleries and the breweries and just the saloon culture in general, they were in a floodplain and got hit several times back to back, which just sort of dampened some of their business.
I can see
affairs.
By your face that you did not intend that pun, but that you embraced it once it was happening.
So, you know, 1903, 1908, we had floods, and then there was a pressure from the religious organizations in the early 1900s. You know, the Kansas City Star stopped printing advertisements that would booze advertisements. And so it was just sort of like these things kind of kept creeping in. And it was even before Prohibition that the Union Depot, which brought all of the tourism, all of the businessmen, all the cowboys, everyone just got dropped into the West Bottoms by the Union Depot when it closed its doors and moved uptown to 20th and Main. It just kind of slowed a lot of business down, and the Rieger Distillery moved almost immediately, simultaneously up near it also. So
it's interesting because it sounds like Kansas City, like at what I'm hearing in this is that there was a cultural shift happening, and that at the same time, geographically, like where business was in the city moved, and that it just didn't pop back up because of the cultural shift elsewhere.
Yeah, I think so. And I mean, you know, just because the distilleries weren't operating doesn't mean there wasn't booze being produced and booze being, you know, spread through the city. Just it wasn't through traditional means anymore. It was in the hands of the bootleggers and all of that. So there was definitely that it was still happening, just not in the way that we
What do we know about the bootlegging activity, especially once Prohibition kicked in and Kansas City did have kind of a reputation for still being fairly wet considering Prohibition?
Well, the Sicilians, the Italians, had total control of bootlegging operations during Prohibition and even after. Pretty much all vice factions in the city were ran by Italian mafia, who was in cahoots with our city boss, Tom Pendergast, and his older brother, Jim Pendergast, who kind of started the relationship early on between the Italians and the Pendergast machine. And it was a hugely successful endeavor for anyone to get into the bootlegging scene.
There's also a lot of bootlegging that was happening in the southeast corner of Kansas, just on the state line with Missouri. So, like, the closest Missouri city to that would have been Joplin, where you just came up from. And I believe it was Crawford County and Cherokee County. And these were, like, more isolated counties that were largely an immigrant population and historically a mining community. But because of their European ancestry, again, like, they had that drinking culture, and they were so remote from the capital of Kansas that they produced lots of alcohol and really disregarded the law enforcement. Once state prohibition kicked in Kansas, again in the 1880s, they went completely into bootlegging, just all in, and produced lots of alcohol. And they even developed this brand name that kind of covered lots of different alcohol, spirits in particular. And the brand name was Deep Shaft, kind of a nod to their mining history in the community. And so they bootlegged extensively across the state line in the southwest corner of Missouri all the way up to Kansas City. And over time, their network spread throughout the U.S. So they were very prolific.
You know, the McCormick's vodka distillery in Weston has been operating since the 19th century, and it's been in its original location all that time. Has any place else stayed in operation from then till now, or are today's distilleries an entirely new crop other than that one?
To my knowledge, I think it's modern distilleries are the new wave. I don't know that of any others that really survived Prohibition. So you're seeing this new wave of craft distilleries that have opened up, that are independently owned. Some of them being, there's Mean Mule, which just opened up earlier this year in the Crossroads, Restless Spirits Distilling in Arkansas City, Tomstown, a reference to Tom Pendergast, Tomstown Distilling in the Crossroads as well, Lifted Spirits, Union Horse Distilling, which I believe was the first modern distillery based in Lenexa, Kansas.
You know, I want to ask you this in a stage whisper, but there's no way to really do that on the radio. Like, are they good?
Absolutely. They each produce really high-quality spirits, many of them award-winning, and they have distinctive qualities between them. I think that's part of the appeal of modern craft distilleries, is that you're not just producing a generic version of bourbon or gin or vodka. You put your own spin on it, because that's what distinguishes the product and the company. And I think as more people have pursued these modern spirits, they're looking for something that's unique and different as a flavor profile.
Why do you think this is seeing a revival now?
I think it's just a thirst for what's new and different. Another pun there.
We just can't help it today.
Yeah, it just rolls off the tongue. but it's, I think what's happening in craft distilling or independent distilling mirrors what's happened with craft brewing, and even before that, food, especially food, and even specialty coffee, like going back to the 90s. I think consumer tastes have shifted over the past few decades, where people want something that's locally made, that's higher quality, that is not mass-produced, that they can really get behind and explore.
You know, Carla, what if you were to make meaning out of the story of distilling in Kansas City, stepping back from it and looking at the long arc, what do you see?
Well, I just want to pick up a little bit on what Pete said about, I mean, it feels like what is happening right now is in such alignment with who we are as a city. It feels like we want meaning. We every think everywhere you look, people are wearing KC hats, KC shirts. The love of our city is so strong, and probably stronger than it's ever been right now. And I think it's this need and desire to create these pure products. I mean, the craft industry in Kansas City, across all coffee, food, booze, everything, is taking it back, almost like a throwback to traditional ways. I mean, one of my dear friends, he's a coffee roaster. He just went to Brazil to like trace his product and create relationships with the farmers who he's buying from. And he's 20 something. I mean, it's just like our generational, I think, desire to create good product that represents the city we love is so strong.
And I like to throw in a quote, and I'm paraphrasing, but John McDonald, the founder of Boulevard Brewing, told me this once in an interview, and it's that people want to support local, not just because it's local, but because it's good. There's two different things. Like, you can have a local product that where the quality is not necessarily there, but people really support local brands where it's great quality.
Well, so now that brings us to the recently opened new space for Jay Rieger and Company in the East Bottoms. Let's go there with KCUR's Aviva Okeson-Haberman as she introduces us to the space and the owners of the distillery, who are bringing some 21st century flair to a historic family brand.
Andy Rieger grew up knowing his family's history. Old shot glasses and advertisements reminded him that he was the great-great-great-grandson of the Jacob Rieger, the founder of a Kansas City distillery in the West Bottoms neighborhood that would become the largest mail-order whiskey business in the U.S. before it was shut down during Prohibition. But as a teenager, Andy didn't think that much about it.
Even to the point that probably in high school, when we were sneaking alcohol from my dad's liquor cabinet, we would use 130-year-old relic shot glasses, thinking that they were totally usable for something like that, and how stupid we were in hindsight. But we always knew that there was that history there. Never really cared, though.
It wasn't until Andy met Ryan Mabee that he considered reviving his family business. They met in 2010 on the opening night of Ryan's restaurant, The Rieger, on the main floor of the Rieger Hotel in the Crossroads.
When I introduced myself and I was so excited that first night, he thought I was just looking for something free, like a free drink or a free appetizer, because I had a connection to the building.
Andy came back the second night, bringing old family artifacts with him.
Ryan realized I was just trying to ensure that they were really kicking butt and taking names and having the best restaurant possible. But I did, by the way, get that free drink on the second night.
In 2014, they relaunched Jay Rieger & Co., and last month they opened a new distillery and bar complex in the East Bottoms. The new space is huge, 60,000 square feet. It's in this old brick building that was originally used for bottling. They kept a lot of its history. The floor is made up of 3-inch thick wood slats that are more than 100 years old. The Monogram Bar is this large open space. They have cocktails on tap and serve food and appetizers, like popcorn with Joe's Kansas City barbecue seasoning.
All right, so right now we are standing outside of our offices on the south side of the building. We have this little catwalk that overlooks our production floors.
Ryan Mabee is showing me around. We're looking down at a 2,500-gallon fermentation tank. There are 5 of these, and as soon as I walk onto the overlook, the smell hits me.
I would describe the smell as delicious. You know, I almost take it for granted now. Like, you come in and, you're fermenting grain and making whiskey and doing all these things, and it's a powerful, powerful aroma, and it's awesome. It's great.
The production space is enclosed in glass walls, so you can see it as you're sipping a cocktail at the bar. It's one of the design elements Ryan hopes will motivate people to make the drive to the East Bottoms. It's out of the way from the typical bar scene. Nearby businesses include a steel company and a towing service.
We have to make it a destination, because we can't rely on, we're not, in the Crossroads or the Plaza or a place with a lot of heavy foot traffic. So this isn't going to be an impulse.
And that's where the 40-foot slide comes in.
The slide may have sounded a little bit crazy, but now it's become kind of the most talked about item or part of the guest experience.
The stainless steel slide snakes down from the Monogram Lounge to the first floor. So, for journalistic purposes, I had to check it out. First, though, there's a list of 12 rules.
Well, you know, having a slide in a bar is probably not a normal thing. And so, you know, there are certain liabilities to take into consideration. You know, you don't want to just let anything go.
No running or diving down the slide.
Don't try and take a cocktail or, you know, your sandwich down the slide with you or anything like that. I don't think there's a rule for not having recording equipment. So, all right, well, here I go. Good? All right. See you down there.
It's slower than I thought it would be. It's slower.
I think that's probably good in this case. But if you want, you can certainly speed up. You know, you can like kind of pick your feet up, lean back a little bit, pick up some speed. You start to figure out those things once you do it a few times. Yeah.
We're now at the exit of the distillery, right by the gift shop. Ryan says he hopes a newly opened space will help showcase the history and fun of a brand that dates back to the late 1800s.
KCUR's Viva Okeson-Haberman brought us that story and rode the slide. And now that we've brought our distilling conversation into the present, we're going to have to wait to see where it goes next. But Pete Doolin, Carla Deal, thank you both for your insights.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
I'm Gina Kaufman, and now we're talking apps and snacks, the foods you share with friends when it's not quite mealtime, when perhaps you are about to ride a slide in the nearby playground at your local bar. What restaurants offer really good options for those casual snacking foods you can graze on? 816-235-2888. The Food Critics will be here when we return. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we're talking apps and snacks and whatever else you share with friends when you gather for drinks or grab and go when you're in a hurry. 816-235-2888 for all the chips and dips and whatever else you like to order when you're tasting and grazing with friends. 816-235-2888. Today's food critics are Jenny Vergara, Carlton Logan, and Jill Silva. Hi, you guys.
Hi.
Good morning. Gina.
So this whole approach to going out and dining as a group, do you think that it is more popular than it used to be, or am I just imagining that? Like the whole grazing together communally thing.
Well, I mean, small plates has ushered that in and made it more of a thing, I think. I mean, we used to go out in groups and we would just all get our own entree and our own salad and our own appetizer.
We would mind our own business.
Yes. And there wasn't the sharing, I think, that there is today. Now, that's only true in kind of traditional Anglo culture, if you will. I mean, a lot of ethnic food obviously is meant to share and has been for many, many centuries.
So, remember the days when spin dip was the go-to thing people got at the table? It feels very passé now, spinach and artichoke dip.
Yeah, no.
Been there, done that.
No, no. That and mozzarella cheese sticks can go bye-bye.
Yes.
Well, you know what? There are some good versions out there, though, of spinach dip, if you can elevate it in some way. So,
what do you is there, like, today's version of that, like, the thing that is sort of feels like today's go-to appetizer or go-to for the table order?
It's funny that you say that. Yeah, guac is one, but also we were talking deviled eggs, right?
Oh,
that
yeah.
was like on every menu for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And there's still some out there, but they go in waves, don't they?
Yeah. I mean, there's always some version of a chip and dip or vegetable and dip that's always, you know, hummus and veg or salsa and chips or chicharrones and guacamole. I mean, there's all those kinds mm-hmm. of chippy dippy things that have been around a long time, but it does change and it does go in waves. And certainly art spin dip in the 90s was the app du jour.
So now that we have our recent history and context, Jenny, I see something on your list that is kind of an oldie but goodie revival type thing, Hanna Fries.
Yeah. So the French Market basically is in the Prairie Village Shopping Center, and they have recently moved and expanded. So they used to be just kind of a little tiny shop. Now they've got quite a bit of space. They've got a kitchen, a brand new bar, a nice dining room, and obviously still all the grab and go stuff that you kind of knew them for. And so it's really turned into kind of a breakfast and lunch and maybe an early dinner kind of happy hour place. And the family that runs it obviously also runs Café Provence, and then they had Hanna's back in the day, which was kind of the original restaurant for them. Hannah Fry's was like one of the most popular, and it is totally a throwback.
It had a cult following.
It did have a cult following.
They had like a curry-esque seasoning.
Right. And since Mary Block isn't with us, somebody has to represent French fries today. So I will be the one to do it with Hannah Fry's. It's just lovely, crispy, thin French fries, perfectly salted. And then it's served with a basil aioli, which is just delicious. Really, really good. So yeah, I mean, if you guys miss Hannah Fry's, miss them no more. You can get them at French Market.
And Carlton, in this land of retro-ish snacks making a return, talk to me about pimento cheese, because you are urging us to get that at Char Bar, but explain the whole like pimento cheese phenomenon.
Pimento cheese is sort of making a comeback. I'm seeing it not only in the grocery store, and I think there's a vendor in City Market. Mm-hmm. The name escapes me right
Little
now.
Bills.
Yeah, Little Bills. Bills.
Yes, Jill's recommending some pimento yes. cheese as well.
And it's making comeback on menus as well.
What is it?
It is...
it's leftover cheese pieces.
Yes, leftover cheese
Let's
pieces.
Let's start there.
Yes, a little mayo and usually some...
butter.
Butter, yes, you gotta have butter. Some red pepper, of course, the pimento part of it. And it's just all blended. Sometimes it's real creamy and sometimes it's... more rough, I would say, more mm-hmm. cheesy than mm-hmm. saucy.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Okay, and so we have two specific recommendations. Jill, yours is Little Bill's.
Oh, Little Bill's. That's actually where I learned about pimento cheese, because it is kind of a southern thing that's becoming a Midwestern thing. And I did not grow up in the Midwest, even so. As a Westerner, I'm like, what is pimento cheese? And I worked with someone who... was from the South, and she's like, oh my goodness, pimento cheese sandwiches, right? So immediately I went to the City Market and got some Little Bills, and I think it's some of the best in town. I eat it by the spoonful when I get it. It's scary.
And so, and then Carlton, Char Bar is where you want us to go.
Yes, Char Bar.
Where you are also recommending other snacks, which I invite you to share.
That is correct. Yes, they do have the pimento cheese. And what's great about it, it is served with these charred grapes.
Charred grapes?
Charred grapes.
Say more.
So the grapes are put on the grill, so they get this real smoky flavor, and they're kind of cooked a little bit. And it sounds odd, but oh my gosh. Those
caramelizes the sugar in the fruit. That makes
exactly,
total sense.
Exactly. I've never tasted anything like it before, and I want to taste it again.
So anything else you want to tell us about on your Char Bar spread?
Yes, the charred bits and grits. It is a platter of cheese grits, and it's topped with burnt ends, sausage, bourbon pick candy, or candied bacon, if you're not familiar with that, and pickled jalapenos. And it is, I'm ready to go back in the fall when it's nice
yeah.
and cold and order it, you know, and maybe, you know, really enjoy it. And, oh, very good.
And so, okay, that's Char Bar.
Mm-hmm.
We also have nachos on various lists here. And so this is bringing us back to the various kinds of chips and dips. But who wants to tell me about some nachos that they like?
I have a nacho on my list.
Timeless.
Mm-hmm. Taqueria Vegana is a new pop-up inside of The Bite in the City Market. The Bite is this lovely kind of mishmash of a sandwich place that serves really excellent food. Most of it with a Latin flair, usually during the week. But on Wednesdays from 5 to 9, they switch over and serve basically a 5 to 6 menu item that's all vegan. And I recently had them at Test Kitchen, so I was really excited to go and taste their food in person. And I have to say, the nachos there give the exact same satisfying, like, crunchy chips and gooey stuff on top of it and beans. And it's got, they call it vegan beef, but it's basically textured beef protein, which is kind of a flaky grind. Candied jalapenos, it's got vegan crema, vegan avocados, obviously loaded with veg. But you still, when you eat it, you get the same satisfaction as if it was protein packed. I mean, it's just like crunchy and gooey, and it's so satisfying. So I'm telling everyone, I mean, listen, I eat everything because of my job, but I have to tell you, I would go back and eat anything on this vegan menu that they're doing. All excellent, excellent.
And Jill, funny enough, the other nacho recommendation we have is from you, and it also is a vegan nacho.
Maddie's Vegan Eats is a new truck that's out and about. I tasted them just once at the Rookie Fair, where they kind of introduce new food trucks, and I was impressed. you know, it was
this
a
is
nice
called Maddie's Vegan.
Maddie's Vegan Eats. Yeah, I think it's worth checking out. I've seen them on the road quite a bit lately. As I'm driving, I'm like, oh, there they are.
We kind of have third wave vegan food happening right now in Kansas City. Yes. I'm super here for that.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just time
explain
for
that briefly.
So, you know, there was kind of what I'll call kind of crunchy granola, you know, I'm eating grains, I'm eating veg, kind of, you know, hardcore vegan. Then there was kind of this middle road where it was like maybe some faux meat, you know, kind of sprinkled in there and in with my veg and my grain that kind of looked like meat but wasn't meat. And now we're really at the point where it's like, let's make all kinds of food vegan, you know, junk food that we miss, things that we really want. And they're doing it with all the flavor. They're bringing all the flavor to it. It's really like this kind of new, and they're taking the form of food trucks and pop-ups. Most of them don't have brick and mortar, so you have to kind of run to go get them. So Pirate Bone might be the one place that's going to have brick and mortar when they get open. So,
you know, so Jill, you were just recommending these vegan nachos from a food truck. It does seem like food trucks are made for this snacking kind of activity because, you know, you're sort of milling about going from place to place. Tell us about a couple of other food trucks that have what you consider great snack foods.
Well, one of my all-time favorites is El Tenedor, which is a Spanish tapas truck. She started off in a little tiny camper and now has two very large trucks, so she's quite mobile. And what's so great about her food is just the beauty of it on the run. It is gorgeous food. You get tapas that you would get in any restaurant. So the empanadas are fantastic. She has these wonderful croquetas, little balls that are deep fried, crispy. They've got mashed potatoes holding some meat together. Just really delicious. And then everything she does is topped with some aioli, so that mayonnaise, and she has one that has a little bit of red pepper in it, so it's a little pink, and then she's got the regular mayo. So she does these squiggles, and then you've got a nice little tuft of salad on the side. Beautiful stuff that you just don't expect to see on the street. But Carmen Cabilla is the chef, and she used to work at Lil's on Summit, so she has that very professional background that gives her a really great eye for elevating snack food.
She might have brought bacon-wrapped dates to Kansas City. She might have been one of the first, at least, to
you
kind of make
You
might
be right. Mm-hmm. Also serving things like paella and squid.
Really
and,
good paella.
You know, really, you would not think of those as food truck foods.
You know, so we'll get back to empanadas, which you have mentioned, because I feel like that is also a very snackable thing. But I want to branch out a little before we head to the break. Butcher boards, cheese plates. This is a variety of popular snacking group grazing kind of order that is becoming pretty, I mean, it has been popular for a while, but it's a lot of places have these things. Carlton, you have some recommendations.
Yes. Rye is always good. They have a butcher board with cured meats that are done in-house, and they serve them with a grainy mustard, pickles, and sliced baguette. Also, another one is, there was another one I was thinking of.
What makes a great butcher board, a great cheese plate? Because in theory, you know, it's just a couple of pieces of meat and some cheese, but like some places do it better than others. What elevates some above others?
I think it's the visual. I mean, there is an art to putting together a beautiful charcuterie or cheese plate or combination of both. So I think that's part of it.
It makes you just feel fancy.
Well, you eat with your eyes first. We all know this, right? Mm-hmm. The other thing I would tell you is that you have to have kind of pickly and salty and sweet somewhere on that board as well. So you've got rich meat and rich cheese, and you need something to cut it.
And you need crunchy and not crunchy.
All that.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Well, you have just a little bit of time to call in with your favorite snacks and apps and shareable treats for grazing with friends at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. Take us to your favorite restaurant to go to when it's not necessarily mealtime. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and I am here with the food critics, who today are Carlton Logan, Jill Silva, and Jenny Vergara. We are talking about apps and snacks and small shareable things that you graze on whatever time of day. And we've just talked about charcuterie plates and cheese boards. I'd like to talk now about those things that are just sort of like quick and portable and you could grab them to go. And empanadas came up earlier, but we didn't really stick with it very long. At the Bite, there are also some things that are sort of like in that category of food. Jenny?
Yeah, I mean, the Bite always does kind of empanada, snacky stuff. Even there, the Taqueria Vegana that we spoke about earlier, the vegan pop-up in there does some good things. But I'm recommending empanadas from Empanada Madness on Southwest Boulevard. They also have a location out south. But, you know, it's just one of those places where you just want to roll in on like a Saturday afternoon. It's maybe a little past lunch. You didn't have lunch. You just need a little something to tie you over to dinner. Get a couple empanadas. Get a nice Mexican soda or even, you know, just
maybe
water.
Stock some Royals players.
Yeah, well, all of that can happen there too, for sure. For sure. But they just do a really nice job. It's a very crispy empanada. It's got a little bit of chew to it, but a nice, you know, and the filling is always seasoned perfectly, flavorful. And I think you can get it in like chicken and beef. And I think there's a cheese or potato and egg one. So yeah, Empanada Madness.
And Jill, you are recommending a street dog as a snack food.
It's a street dog that's not on the street, but it is Krogstrom Club's Scandinavian hot dog. And I love that. It was in parlor for a while back at the bar there. And it's a pickled polsa that's made by Fritz's. It's a super long dog that hangs out of its bun, has curry ketchup and leeks, fried leeks on top, a little bit of pickle. And I'm not a hot dog person, and I love this thing. So it's definitely my favorite hot dog in town.
It's a great bar food.
Isn't it?
It's just great.
Yeah.
It is great.
I'm so glad they have found a way to keep that.
Absolutely.
That going.
It needs a home.
It does.
Let's talk to, we've got a caller named Arjun calling us from Kansas City at 816-235-2888. Arjun, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What do you want to tell us about?
I want to talk about a great spot for shareable grazing, communal eating with friends. I'm sure you guys know it, La Bodega. They have a wonderful happy hour, lots of great options. Sangria is wonderful. But specifically, it's these chicken and chorizo skewers with this like garlic aioli that's just mouthwatering and great for sharing. So many good options, and the happy hour price is budget-friendly.
Well, thanks, Arjun. So that's La Bodega for shareable things. And so we are just hearing about some skewers that have chorizo and chicken. Something that I think of as sort of like a similar style of recommendation, Carlton, you're talking about the fried calamari at Tres Omare.
Yes, the fried calamari. Usually when you order calamari, it's usually those little rings. And mm-hmm. Sometimes you get, you know, like little baby octopus. At Tres Omare, they're actually cut in strips. So they're nice little strips, and they're breaded, and there's a little Parmesan kind of sprinkled on top and a little marinara on the side, and they're very good.
And Jenny, you've got some calamari to recommend at Capitol Grill.
So I have to tell you, I've eaten at Capitol Grill twice, once at the old place and once now at the new place, which just opened up last night. And, you know, it had been a minute since I'd been in there. Obviously, there's so many new places to try. It's hard to get back to old places. But I wanted to be sure to kind of have an experience in both. And I have to tell you, that appetizer has stood the test of time. This is basically pan-fried. It's breaded calamari, not the rings. You get kind of a little bit of all of it, some tentacles, some little legs in there if that's your thing. But it's breaded and pan fried, and it's served with hot cherry peppers and I think some what's the green one? I always forget the name. Pepperoncini. So basically what it is they fry up this beautiful calamari, they put it on a platter, and then they chop it up and kind of mix it with like Peppadue peppers, kind of a sweet, pickly, a little bit of heat, pepperoncini as well, vinegar, a little bit of heat, and they mix it all together. And I'm telling you, they don't serve it with any sauce. Like there's no dipping sauce, there's none of that. And it's the vinegar kind of goes over all of the crunchy pieces of calamari, and it spices it and gives it flavor, and you can't eat one without the other. Like you have to have a bite of calamari and a bite of this pepper in it. But it just reminded me that there are some old favorites. That has been on the menu since day one, really, at Capitol Grill, and it's still holds up, I'm here to tell you. And if you haven't seen the new Capitol Grill, wait till you see it.
Jill, you've got another seafood snack, some spicy jumbo shrimp.
Oh, yes, definitely. Jarocho restaurant, which there's one out south, and there's also one on Kansas Avenue. I personally really adore the Kansas Avenue location. And they have cucaracha shrimp. And those shrimp are a little bit fiery, a little bit garlicky, and you can pay for somebody to take the tails and heads off, or you can actually do it yourself. And I would advise, go ahead, dive in, get your fingers dirty. It's just one of the most delicious starter snacks, I think, out there that's a seafood component. And I think it's great fun.
Why do you recommend diving in and getting your fingers dirty, just out of curiosity?
Well, you know, that's, we don't have enough food that allows us to do that. And I think that that is a really a part of eating that, you know, we don't always, we don't always need the fork, right?
It's the sensual part that we're missing.
It's the sensual part, yeah,
that we're missing. That is a part of snacking, too, is like you just like reach in a basket.
Finger food, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk to Elliot in Prairie Village. Hi, Elliot.
Hi. I'd like to make a recommendation to put together a snacking board by going to Broadway Butcher Shop and choosing some meats and some really well curated cheeses, and to kind of put together everything you would need to kind of bring to a party or a shareable situation, and you can have some really high quality things that you can't get everywhere.
And that's an interesting point. There are a lot of butcher shops and places that do kind of, if you were looking to create the same kind of like snacking style of spread that you could get at a restaurant at like a party that you're having, there are a lot of places that would be good for assembling the things you need in a really kind of like Casey specific way. Other recommendations? Elliot is recommending Broadway Butcher Shop. Where else might you go to do that?
Better Cheddar would be a great one.
Mm-hmm. And we also got a call from someone who likes Kirkland brand snacks at Costco. So shout out to Richard in Kansas City who called in with that recommendation. We also are, we do have some recommendations on Twitter that I want to share. We are seeing Will saying Savory Addictions Nuts.
Yeah, that's a good one. Mm-hmm. I think we all know the couple that's behind that, and they've been doing those for a while. You can get those, I believe, at the bar at J. Rieger and... Or I'm sorry, at The Rieger, I should say. Now that we have a distillery, we can't go. The Rieger. And one other place, I can't, Boulevard maybe? Boulevard, I think. The Boulevard Beer Hall.
And we are also hearing from Melody that duck fat kettle corn at Sava is good.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that is just a true snacking food. Like that's a
popcorn.
Pop it in your mouth kind of thing.
And so, Jill, you have recommended a couple of poutines. And their time was you didn't have multiple poutine options in Kansas City. I'm interested that this very heavy Canadian specialty has entered our culinary culture.
Yeah, well, so the one that I'm thinking of is Monk's Roast Beef, which is a food truck. And
you're also recommending some poutine at Q39.
That's right. Yes, it pops up in a lot of places. And I'll be honest, I did not know until I had it at Monk's during a food truck festival for the Star what poutine was. I'd heard of it. I wasn't sure how to say it.
it's like French fries with
French
gravy
fries
and
with
curds.
Gravy and cheese curds, yes. And, you know, the French
I
fries will
get soggy. I
understand
that in Canada it's basically hangover food.
It is, I think.
They have full shops dedicated to it in Canada.
Yeah. Yeah. And
open till 3 a.m.
Q39 also has that option on their shareable. So, I mean, something that I was unaware of is now, again, popping up and becoming quite popular.
And chicharrones are also, I feel like, you see that more and more. Carlton?
Yes.
What are chicharrones and where do you like to get them?
Chicharrones are basically pork rinds.
Fried.
Fried pork rinds, yes. One of my favorite is strips chicken. Strips is basically chicken strips, but they have other things as well. But they do, they fry their own chicharrones, and it comes with this really zingy kind of hot sauce with the little horseradish, and they're very fresh.
What, can I just ask, I grew up like not eating pork products, and I tried chicharrones first as an adult, and I'm not sure, what are they supposed to taste like? Is it supposed to be mostly crackle and air?
Pretty much crackle, air, a little salt.
Okay, no. I wasn't sure if I was eating an unusual version or if that's the deal.
Undeniable pork flavor. I mean, you know, bacon.
I was going to say, pork belly. It does taste like bacon.
Yes.
But okay. Like a cheese puff at the same time. You know, that texture.
Yep. That texture, yep. Yes.
Yeah.
Thank you for this cultural lesson. Our time is up. Jenny Vergara, contributing editor for Feast Magazine. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Jill Silva, freelance food writer and overall food person who does lots of food things, too many to count. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Carlton Logan, food writer for kcfoodguys.com and co-administrator of Kansas City Eats on Facebook. Carlton, you've been awesome. Thank you.
Thank you, Gina.
You can get Central Standard's official list of the best apps and snacks in Kansas City at kcur.org over the weekend. I know I will be using that reference material a lot. So thanks to everyone who tweeted in to contribute to it. Anything you missed on our show over the week is available at kcur.org/Central Standard. This show is produced by Melody Rowell, Ann Kniggendorf, and intern Riley Kester. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. Linda Scher runs the board for us every day, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. I'm Gina Kaufman. Happy eating, over and out.